Catskill.
Live from the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, the Senate Republicans right now are trying to secure votes to pass their sweeping tax and domestic policy bill, which includes significant cuts to social services. Those proposed federal Medicaid changes could shake the foundation of rural health care, cutting coverage for individuals and putting more pressure on already struggling hospitals. What does it mean for our region, especially after the recent news of service reductions at Garnet Health? We break it down with River Reporter journalist Liam Mayo. Circle Park in the town of Lumberland is growing more than flowers. It's growing future leaders. We'll talk about how they're inspiring young people to take pride in public spaces in Sullivan County. The latest episode of CatsCast takes us on the long path. Plus, nobody puts this show in a corner, the Songs of Dirty Dancing tribute concert. We'll learn more after the news.
Live from NPR News, I'm Korva Coleman. Senators are preparing to eventually vote on the multi-trillion dollar tax cut and spending bill. It's backed by President Trump. Senators spent all night debating possible amendments to the bill. President Trump says he is confident the legislation will pass the Senate.
We're trying to break it down so it's really good for the country. We're trying to get a lot for everybody, and it's a big bill. And smaller bills would have been easy, but they wouldn't have been as good.
Trump is now headed for Florida. He's going to visit a new facility built on an airstrip west of Miami. It's intended to hold thousands of people illegally in the U.S. It has been dubbed Alligator Alcatraz. The remote area is surrounded by an alligator-infested swamp. The Justice Department is now aggressively prioritizing efforts to strip naturalized U.S. citizens of their citizenship. NPR's Jacqueline Diaz reports the DOJ is focused on cases where naturalized American citizens commit certain crimes.
The new stance towards naturalized citizens who commit crimes is laid out in a memo from the Justice Department to its Civil Division employees. Those crimes could include anything from national security incidents to cases of fraud, according to the memo. According to 2023 data, 25 million immigrants are naturalized U.S. citizens. Denaturalization has existed for decades and was used widely to deport citizens accused of being communists during the 1950s. Some immigration attorneys have expressed concerns over this expanded denaturalization effort, questioning whether it is constitutional and how the families of naturalized citizens would be impacted. Jacqueline Diaz, NPR News.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says he plans to visit Washington next week to meet with President Trump. He'll also meet other officials, including Trump's special Mideast envoy, Steve Witkoff, and congressional leaders. Separately, health officials in Gaza say Israeli attacks have now killed at least 130 people in that enclave since yesterday. Stocks opened mixed this morning after gaining ground yesterday. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average gained about 95 points in early trading.
Tesla shares are trading lower after renewed sniping between CEO Elon Musk and President Trump. Musk has criticized the big spending and tax cut bill now making its way through the Senate. Trump, who backs that measure, suggested he might retaliate by going after government subsidies for Musk's companies. There's another battle brewing over discount yoga pants. Lululemon, the maker of pricey athletic wear, is suing Costco, accusing the warehouse chain of selling unauthorized knockoffs of its products. The federal lawsuit alleges that Costco has infringed on Lululemon's patents and is unlawfully trading on its reputation, goodwill, and sweat equity. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR News. The Trump administration is suing Los Angeles. It claims the city blocked its ability to enforce federal immigration law. The lawsuit also claims Los Angeles sanctuary city policies stop local LA police from sharing information about people who are illegally in the United States. Some Los Angeles City Council members say the lawsuit is baseless. Starting today, people in Wyoming can carry concealed guns in public places where they were previously banned. From Wyoming Public Radio, Chris Clements reports states enacting similar laws have experienced spikes in firearm-related injuries.
Wyoming Representative Jeremy Haroldson, a member of the State Freedom Caucus, is excited. This week, gun-free zones in public schools and buildings will disappear.
I look forward to just seeing what that means for the safety of our students, the safety of our employees and workers.
But an analysis from the Gun Violence Data Hub found states with similar laws, like Ohio, Nebraska, and Georgia, have seen a spike in gun-related injuries since they were adopted. Academic research on the subject shows more guns frequently lead to more crime, not less. For NPR News, I'm Chris Clements in Laramie.
Gas prices are cheaper ahead of this 4th of July holiday weekend compared to a year ago. The Motoring Club AAA says the average national price of a gallon of regular is a little less than $3.18 a gallon. That's about 30 cents cheaper than it was a year ago. You're listening to NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Capital One, offering their premium travel card, Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And listeners like you who donate to this NPR station.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for joining us. As the Senate prepares to finalize a budget that could strip $4 billion nationally from the Medicaid program, local health officials and elected representatives are speaking out about what that change could mean for rural care. This past Friday, the Pennsylvania Department of Health Secretary Dr. Deborah Bogan, along with other officials from the Shapiro administration, held a press conference with Wayne Memorial Hospital in Honesdale. The goal was to talk about the potential impacts from the federal Medicaid changes, from how they will impact individual people's health care coverage to how they'll imperil an already strained rural health care system. Liam Mayo of the River Reporter joins us now to break down the numbers, the broader implications for the region, and who stands to be affected, even those not currently on Medicaid. Liam, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You're reporting on in the River Reporter at riverreporter.com. You report from that press conference on Friday. What were those officials saying about these potential impacts and projections for the changes?
Yeah, a lot of what they were there to do was to talk about some of the specific numbers they were seeing for how this will affect Pennsylvanians. They estimated that around 300,000 Pennsylvanians could lose their Medicaid coverage under the latest proposals coming out of Congress. We looked over at some of the figures from New York, and over there was an estimate of around 1.5 million New Yorkers who could potentially lose their healthcare coverage statewide. Besides the Medicaid-specific impacts, the Pennsylvania Insurance Commissioner, Michael Humphreys, estimated that around a further 270,000 Pennsylvanians who have individual insurance through the state's insurance marketplace, Penny, could lose that coverage. And that's coming from a couple of the other proposals that aren't Medicaid specific that are in this bill. These are proposals to sort of allow some enhanced tax credits to expire, which would kick around 150,000 people off their insurance, estimated Humphreys, as well as changes in policies around enrollment in state, these affordable health insurance programs. So those were kind of the numbers they were seeing as far as the individual people who could be losing their health insurance because of the changes coming out of the federal government. But the broader picture they were there to talk about was the ripple effects that's going to have on rural healthcare. The CEO of Wayne Memorial Hospital, James Pettinato, he talked about the hospital's kind of current financial condition as being strained. He said that the hospital has been working to enhance services throughout its coverage area, but that even as it's been working to enhance its services and it's been getting a lot of support from local governments and from state government in order to do so, the area is still considered underserved. So even though they've been trying to improve their services, they could use with more support, not less. And that's sort of what the impact of these changes coming out of the federal government would be. It would be less support hitting the healthcare system in general, which is already strained, and then having an outsized effect on rural healthcare and rural hospitals.
Yeah, and in your reporting, the Way Memorial CEO James Pettinato said, quote, "The proposed budget cuts would likely force us over time to reduce services and continue to leave the most vulnerable population of patients at greater risk for disastrous health outcomes," end quote. That's the CEO of Wayne Memorial right here in our region. That's not some rhetoric coming out of Washington or some budget office somewhere or some cable news talking head. That's a real impact in our region.
Yeah, and he sort of went, or other, he and other officials from Wayne Memorial went a little further into the individual impacts that they could see. He talked about how Wayne Memorial Hospital is one of the few hospitals in the area that's still, or few rural hospitals in the state that's still delivering babies. He says they deliver about 475 babies a year, if I'm remembering that figure correctly. And he said that a lot of that is possible through Medicaid. He said that a lot of those babies are covered by medical insurance, and that a lot of those births are of high-risk patients who the health of the mother or the health of the child could be affected by not having this sort of really skilled coverage available locally. And he said that this is something where over in Susquehanna County, there was another hospital over there that had an OBGYN program or that had the ability to deliver babies, and that hospital recently, I think in 2011, 2012, lost that program and that ability to deliver babies. So it's not just the hospital as a whole could suffer, and we could see individual cuts to services here and there or little slimmings around the margins. It's possible that Wayne Memorial's child delivery program could go the way of other programs statewide. Now, that's, to be clear, that's something that he did not say these changes will force us to cut this program. This is just one of the types of programs that is currently strongly supported by Medicaid and that would face some impacts as these changes to Medicaid come through.
And these changes to Medicaid are not just impacting Northeast Pennsylvania. There were some changes announced earlier in June from Garnet Health, talking about shrinking federal reimbursements as well as additional anticipated federal cuts to the Medicaid program that forced them to face some difficult decisions, as their CEO, Garnet Health CEO Jonathan Schiller, said in the River Reporter. So can you talk a little bit more about how these changes fit in the overall picture of those declining services at Garnet Health? And then if you knit those together regionally, just a real, like, I don't know, healthcare desert in some ways could be possible.
Yeah, that is absolutely a possibility. It's not just that one hospital is sort of in a position where it needs to reduce services and other hospitals will sort of be able to pick up the slack. All hospitals are going to be feeling these impacts. Garnet Health announced, as you said, that it would be firing or letting go of 42 employees and cutting a couple of services. It's outpatient pulmonary rehabilitation services, as well as its outpatient diabetes services. And those services are part of a broader trend from Garnet Health of over the past couple of years, even over the past decade or so, trying to reduce the amount of services it provides, or just trying to sort of right size the hospital for the population that it currently sees. A couple of years ago, we talked with Garnet Health CEOs, and they said that the current sort of building that they're working out of was built in the 1970s when the region had a booming tourist population, and that based on the changes in population and based on the changes in medicine, that building and that the sort of services they're providing are kind of too much for the region, and they're trying to sort of create another building or trying to reduce the amount of services there. So whereas with Wayne Memorial, Pennato said that they're trying to boost services and this Medicaid cuts could sort of take the wind out of their sails, these cuts could sort of increase or add momentum to sort of a spiral of reducing services that is in some ways present over at Garnet Health. And it's the Medicaid changes kind of feed into that because of their outsized impact they're going to have on rural hospitals. And that was sort of one of the things that the Pennsylvania Department of Health employees were trying to emphasize at that Wayne Memorial press conference. One of the reasons they were at Wayne Memorial, a rural hospital. And the ripple effects they were talking about came in a couple of different ways. They said that a lot of patients or an outsized number of patients in rural areas are on Medicaid just because rural hospitals serve more vulnerable populations. Rural hospitals serve generally poorer populations. So hospitals in rural areas will lose more money essentially from Medicaid changes than hospitals in more urban areas will. And in addition to that, not only will it sort of lose the Medicaid funding from those patients who no longer have it, those patients are still going to need health care. And those patients, even if it's just emergency health care, those patients will still be coming to the hospital, but they'll be coming to the hospital in the back of an ambulance, and they'll be coming to the hospital in ways that the hospital can't really charge for. It's going to have to be uncompensated care. And that's going to not only strain the margins of these rural hospitals that in many cases are already very slim or in the negative. These changes that uncompensated care will get spread to other paying patients in the form of higher insurance premiums or reduced services. So the message they were really trying to say is that these changes coming down from the federal level, like the big picture or the headline changes are the changes to Medicaid, but the healthcare system is called a healthcare system for a reason. It's kind of an interconnected thing. So $4 billion being taken out of the Medicaid budget, in addition to the other changes that they are proposing, will have this ripple effect that affects everyone's care, not just those people who rely on Medicaid.
Yeah, people that aren't even on Medicaid, including people who brought insurance through the state healthcare marketplaces. Pennsylvania's Insurance Commissioner Michael Humphreys was there as well, who said that about 270,000 Pennsylvanians who have individual insurance through the state's health insurance marketplace, Penny, could lose their coverage because the expiration of extended tax credits, insurance tax credits. We need to go, but the great reporting here and a lot of statistics that are breaking down these national numbers into understandable local numbers. And I just want to read one more thing from your report in New York. A May report from the Fiscal Policy Institute estimated that around 37,500 people could lose health insurance coverage throughout New York's 19th congressional district. That's our district here that includes Sullivan County. Estimated that 1.5 million New Yorkers could lose coverage, but 37,500 people just in our district alone could lose health insurance coverage if these cuts go through, which Senate is debating right now as we speak. Liam Mayo, great reporting here on the rural health care impact of these Medicaid cuts if they do go through. You can read that at riverreporter.com. Liam Mayo, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
We'll take a break, and when we come back, did you know that parks can boost your mental health in honor of National Park and Recreation Month? We speak to the Town of Lumberland team about how their work at Circle Park is planting the seeds of a healthier community. This is Radio Chatskill.
This week on This American Life, Mahmoud Khalil was in detention for more than 3 months because the Trump administration said he engaged in anti-Semitic activity in Columbia University protests. We talked to him about the Shabbat and Passover services he's been to with his Jewish friends, and playing a Jewish character in a middle school play in a Palestinian refugee camp. The Real Mahmoud, this week.
This American Life, Saturday night at 6 on Radio Catskill.
America is deeply polarized. Families and communities are at odds over politics. But there are also many Americans who are trying to bridge divides.
This conflict, there's no one's going to win. I think the only way through is together.
Tune in to Americans Reconnect, talking across the political divide. I'm Nina Moyney from APM.
Join us Friday at 6 for Americans Reconnect, right here on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. July kicks off National Park and Recreation Month. This nationwide initiative, led by the National Recreation and Park Association, celebrates the essential role parks and recreation play in building stronger, healthier, and more connected communities. Joining us now with more about the local effort are Carmela Hugo, Sullivan 180's Beautification Manager, and Linda Hazen, Volunteer Lead and Sullivan 180 Intern Supervisor with the Town of Lumberland. They're going to share how community partnerships, education, and volunteerism come together in places like Circle Park in the Town of Lumberland to nurture both natural beauty and public well-being. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Linda, you've got deep roots in Sullivan County.
I sure do.
You've got lots of service behind you. Why do you think the spaces like Circle Park matter to a community's well-being and pride and sense of connection?
Circle Park is a very unique park in that its origins stemmed from a tragic death of a community member. And she was an 11-year-old girl, and she happened to be my niece. And it just shattered the community. We had a family that is so involved in the community and just did so many things, volunteerism and this and that and the other. And we have been part of Glens Bay in the Town of Lumberland for generations. And it really affected a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And it really crushed a lot of people. And there were these four women. They came on board and they were like, we are going to help this town heal. And they built Circle Park, and they went to get them right places and the right people and the right monies and the right vision. And our town just came together in a healing way that was absolutely phenomenal, in that we took a side of a hill that was completely forested and just chiseled it out with volunteer workers. And excavators showed up and things people showed up, and it was a phenomenal thing. And it has done nothing but grow in the last 21 years, and it's just turned into an amazing place to be.
So we talked about how parks can be, you know, important for your mental health, and this park in particular, especially as you describe it, is a healing place.
It's a healing place. It's truly healing. We really focus in on the aesthetics as far as the gardenings go. And it's an amazing place. It really is. And it's filled with multi-generational activities to do. And it's just evolved over the years. And it's fantastic.
Carmela, you are the beautification manager for Sullivan 180, known for doing so much beautification throughout the county. You've seen parks like this throughout your time here. What makes a park like Circle Park helping bring people together of all backgrounds and generations? How does it do that?
Oh, I actually was part of that community. I was part of that community when we lost Boo. And so I was Linda's niece. And so to experience it on that level, and then now fast forward so many years later to help groups to put together parks and beautification throughout the county has been really incredible for me to, you know, work with them. I forget your question.
That's all right. You answered it. Linda, okay. How do you engage students in this beautification effort for this park, and then connect them to this meaningful part of the park who may not have known your niece?
You know, fortunately, I was a sixth grade teacher at the Eldred High School, or pardon me, the Eldred School District for 34 years. And our elementary school is located just across the street from the park. So as a sixth grade thing, we would always have the kids take a little bit of ownership every year. Like, now you're in sixth grade. Now you get to go help maintain the park. Now you get all these extra responsibilities. And it was just a phenomenal thing where the kids just came on board and they just felt very special.
What kind of lessons do you think they take from caring for such a public space that's so meaningful to the community?
The lesson that they would take?
Yeah, what lessons do you think they take away from this work?
Well, just by working together. just by working together and by – we always turned it into a math lesson where it's like, okay, if 40 of us work for 20 minutes, think of the man hours that you're saving me as an individual working. You know, how many hours does that relate to? But they just take it away, and they take away ownership, and they just are really very – they're very proud to be a part of it. And then, of course, we would always let them play. You give us 15 minutes of work, and we'll let you play for 45, and it always worked out.
Carabella, do you want to talk about some of the other beautification projects that are going on throughout the county through this season's beautification effort and some of the other parks involved?
Oh, sure. Let's see. We have a lot of community beautification. We have Calicoon Business Association, Calicoon Depot, Livingston Manor beautification. We also have White Sulphur Springs, and these are groups that have been around with Sullivan Renaissance and now Sullivan 180 for many years, and they just keep enhancing their public spaces. We're now also working with schools to beautify their campuses and outdoor learning spaces to create a nice space for students to go as far as learning, you know, promoting health opportunities and movement and access to nature and stress reduction. So that's been really a lot of fun for me to bring it from the entrance of schools into the campus.
And all of that aligns with Sullivan 180's larger mission to encourage yes. and build a healthier Sullivan County community.
Absolutely.
Linda, you know, before we go, how do you see Circle Park, you know, continuing this mission of helping folks to heal, really? Do you want to grow it more?
And you know what? We have been growing it, and it's not necessarily the people, you know, are healing and the people are doing great. And now we have so many visitors come and they're like, this park is so special. And it's like, that's how it's meant to be. It's meant to be a special park. It's meant, you know, we don't need to tell people a tragic story yeah. all the time. And it's meant to be special. It's meant to be multi-generational, and it's just meant for people to be able to come and enjoy. And we are changing it up all the time. And we're excited about it. Yeah. Just very excited about it. And we're very excited about the different programs and stuff that we can have there where we do involve more people and more children.
And you can use this as a model for other people in other parks and other communities to, you know, make this center's place.
Absolutely.
This gathering
and we do
place.
Have our other organizations. We had our Lions Club come in, and they built during COVID, they built a story walk through our nature trail in the back of the thing. And it's just, you know, people are it's fantastic. It's just a wonderful thing. So
it is a great space.
Linda Hazen is the volunteer lead in Sullivan 180 intern supervisor with the town of Lumberland, and Carmela Hugo, of course, Sullivan 180's beautification manager. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
There's more information at
Sullivan180.org.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
We'll take a break. And when we come back, walking the long path from Manhattan to the Catskills. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated. Presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale. Dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. TheCooperageProject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at WJFFradio.org.
On the next Radio Lab,
we're talking about the magical substance that is breast milk.
We're on a quest to find out why our baby's most nourishing lifeline carries an alien sugar.
It's actually the third largest compound in breast milk
that does seemingly nothing for us.
What's crazy about it is humans can't digest this stuff at all.
That's on the next Radio Lab. Wednesday at 1 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. You can drive from New York City to the Catskills in just a few hours, but as Doobie, the taxi driver in Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, says, quote, you don't see nothing on the interstate but the interstate. In this excerpt from the latest episode of Cats Cast, host Brett Berry walks with Casey Kelbaugh on a stretch of the Long Path. It's a 358-mile trail from the George Washington Bridge in New York City to the edge of the Adirondack Park. And Brett is joining us now. Brett, good morning.
Good morning, Tim. I love that line. Every time I take a scenic route, my family yells at me, and I tend to quote that line.
You're quoting only the scholars there. Tell me more about the long path. I think that I had read about this in the travel section of the New York Times.
Yeah, so same guy who wrote this article about his experience hiking the long path from his apartment on the Lower East Side of Manhattan to his home in the Catskills. And this is entirely possible thanks to the long path, which is a path that goes from the George Washington Bridge all the way to the edge of the Adirondacks and stitches together existing trails, paths, and even roadways. By following those markers, you can get all the way here.
One of our contributors, Tracy Gates, interviewed Casey last year, but she didn't go on the path. You actually went on a walk with Casey. Where did you go and how far did you go?
Yeah, we took a little stretch of it in Phoenicia on Romer Mountain. And this was particularly special for Casey recollecting on this section because there is a spring there. And by this point in the journey, which was probably day 26, he was like really conserving his water because he hadn't had any fresh sources in a couple of days. So this was kind of an oasis for him.
Well, let's take a listen. It's the latest episode of Cats Cast. This is an excerpt. Brett Berry walking with Casey Kelbaugh on a stretch of the long path. Brett, thanks so much.
Thanks, Tim.
If you're heading back and forth to New York City anytime soon, Casey Kelbaugh found a way that avoids tolls, traffic, road rage, and congestion pricing. It just might take a while. On September 12th, 2024, The New York Times printed an article titled Walking from Manhattan to the Catskills on the Long Path, and the writer, Casey Kelbaugh, writes that he discovered the path by spotting one of its trail markers behind his house in Edgewood, Greene County, New York. Here's Casey.
My name is Casey Kelbaugh. I am a photographer. I'm based between Alphabet City or the East Village, East 4th Street, and my house in Edgewood, which is a hamlet within Lanesville, within the town of Hunter. I try to split my time about half and half in a perfect world, depending on work and seasons and so forth.
I admitted that I didn't know too much about the long path, and Casey offered to hike a small but significant stretch of it with me. We met in Phoenicia, and he drove us to the Romer Mountain trailhead. Along the way, on a road I knew well, he pointed out a series of long path trail markers that I was now noticing for the first time.
So we're actually currently on the long path. You see that swatch right there?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so we're just along the southern banks of the Esopus River. And, we're sort of driving through a neighborhood, but we're also on the long path.
In the 1930s, Raymond Torrey rallied support for the long path through a series of New York Post columns called The Long Brown Path, named after a line in Walt Whitman's poem, Song of the Open Road. Today, the path stretches 358 miles from the George Washington Bridge in New York City to the Adirondack Park. Or you can stop halfway in the Catskills. The path utilizes a network of existing trails and roadways, and it's marked by aqua trail markers and blazes on trees with directional symbols, reminiscent of the hobo code. We followed some of those blazes to Phoenicia's Romer Mountain trailhead, where Casey Kelbaugh offered me some hiking poles.
Do you want to borrow a pair, or are you okay?
That's okay. I like to hike totally unprepared. No poles, no water.
Yeah. Well, the good news is we're bound for a spring. But I will say these poles prevented upwards of 100 sprained ankles and, broken ribs and so forth. I was able to prevent a lot of falls with them.
The spring we were hiking to had been, at the tail end of Casey's hike from the city, a very welcome discovery.
I have no firm recollection of how far in this thing is, but it was, you know, a classic desert oasis kind of situation because I was coming from Picamoose up over Slide Mountain, Wittenberg, Cornell, all those mountains. I was on a ridge for days and days, so there was no water sources. So I was really, really making my water last and not able to bathe or anything, which kind of wears.
Now, have you been hiking for a long time before you decided to embark on this?
So I grew up primarily in Seattle. Hiking, climbing, doing things in the mountains is kind of like, it's what we did, you know, especially high school and then through college. But I had never, A, done a solo trip overnight, and B, done a trip that lasted more than, say, 8 days. So this was a very different experience. The most significant thing I changed, rather than sleeping in a tent, which is what I had always done in the past, I opted for a hammock system, which I can't say enough good things about. You know, I wasn't sure I would be able to do this. I didn't know if I would finish. You know what I mean? I started it kind of quietly because I didn't want to have to bring my tail home between my legs. It was something I felt I needed to do. I couldn't quite explain why, and I couldn't quite justify it, nor did I want to talk about it much because I was a little bit unsure of how things would pan out.
You weren't out to set any records. You just wanted to complete it. Complete that stretch from your house to your house, or your apartment to your house.
Yes, you are correct. I was in the opposite of a rush. Yeah, I didn't consider it like in any way like a feat of athleticism, you know? It turned out to be really, really hard. I, for some reason, having hiked a lot, just assumed I just had to stack up a number of days of that, you know? But the cumulative effect, I think, is pretty significant, you know? I probably averaged a little under 11 and a half miles a day, which with a 35-pound pack in, like, peak summer heat and humidity was a lot, you know?
Normally, describe your route from the Lower East Side to Lanesville, New York.
Yeah, so it's a pretty straightforward drive. It's actually one of the reasons I kind of fell in love with this area is because it was such a nice experience getting up here. Because you go Palisades to the Thruway to Route 28, which takes you right into Phoenicia, as you know, and then it's Route 214. So not a lot of strip malls and kind of suburban sprawl, but I, you know, having gone back and forth hundreds of times, I was starting to wonder what the connective tissue looked like between these two places. And you'd get little glimpses. The Thruway is like it doesn't show a lot of leg, you know? You don't see any of these roads. You don't get to see much behind the sort of like screen of trees, and you're kind of left guessing. You see a corner of an old stone house here, and then you see what looks like there's just like little hints of interesting communities along the way. And so I was curious to see how it all connected and fit together. And I do an annual hike with some close guy friends every year. And one of them was on the Devil's Path, which is up behind my house. And I saw this trail marker that read the Long Path. And it was actually just very nice graphic design, to be honest, that drew me in. And I was like, oh, well, that looks like it's something. It's not nothing, you know? And I looked it up when I got home and realized that it went essentially from the George Washington Bridge to the Adirondacks. And that I could potentially get from house to apartment with three turns, you know? 4th Street to Broadway, Broadway to the GW Bridge, GW Bridge to the Long Path. And that was just a little too seductive not to at least entertain. And when, you know, life circumstances allowed for a gap in between, I kind of saw the window and realized that I needed to go. And that happened to coincide with the first day of summer 2024. I had spent a couple months prepping, researching gear. The weekend prior, I was you know, beta testing the hammock system with the tarp and the bug envelope that goes around it if needed in friends' backyards and stuff, and sleeping, you know, in people's, you know, backyards, including my own. Yeah, so I was kind of dialing in my kit, so to speak, and I did have my best friend, Alex Ammerman. Shout out, Alex. Basically, he used my car to meet me every 8 days with food if I had to swap out any gear and so forth, and then I would continue on. But every time I met with a friend or stayed at a friend's house, you know, they were obviously off trail, I would be dropped back in the exact same spot.
Let's go back to your normal voyage to the Catskills. How long does that trip usually take by car?
You know, I'm usually running an errand or two along the way, but I would say it averages 2 hours and 15 minutes, maybe 2 hours and 30 minutes.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
But you found another way and increased that time to 27 days.
Yeah, I mean, how could I resist? You know, I'm sure it could have been done more quickly, but I was constantly, there was a constant tension of, do I stay and sit and have a barbecue with this Dominican family outside of this public pool I found in the middle of High Tor State Park, or do I continue on? Do I stay and try to get this specific photograph that I have set up, or do I try to get another mile in before dark, you know? Always this sort of tension between trying to, you know, not make the hike like ungodly long, you know, get from point A to point B within the same season.
While enjoying yourself along the way.
Yeah, enjoying it and trying to actually absorb what I was seeing, experiencing, the people I was meeting, the, you know.
Had you already contracted to do a story for the Times?
I had not. In fact, you know, as I mentioned, I was unsure of whether I was going to make it. From the outset, I knew I wanted to make a book. What the form of that was a little unclear, but I thought that to publish something right off the bat would be a good way to kind of get some momentum for the project. So I reached out the next morning after this. I arrived on July 16th. Brian Lehrer on WNYC had a call in for like, what is this? We're halfway through summer today. What is the best, your summer best or whatever, like the best thing you've done, best ice cream, best whatever.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And for our last 10 minutes, we will lighten it up. We're about halfway through summer. And with these last few minutes of the show, let's spend just a little time away from the news and politics.
So I hemmed and hawed for a second. Then I called in. And within 60 seconds, I'm on air with Brian Lehrer.
How about Casey in Edgewood? You're on WNYC. Hi, Casey.
Good morning, Brian. How are you?
Good. What you got?
So I just completed last night a 27-day hike on the Long Path, and I left my apartment on East 4th Street in Alphabet City on the first day of summer and walked to my house in the Catskills here wow. in Hunter. So
that's great.
And I'm telling him about this, you know, 27-day hike, and I got an audible gasp out of him, which I felt like was a real success, you know. So that was a nice reminder that it was something that others would maybe find interesting, you know. So then I started talking to various editors at the Times and elsewhere. And having contributed photographs to the Times for almost 20 years, I had some relationships and they were, you know, supportive. And thankfully, the travel section was receptive and they enabled me to tell the story as pretty close to how I intended to.
And so you say in your article.
Okay. And so I leaned in and sought out every swimming hole, public pool, and waterfall into which I could sink my battered body. I tried to decipher songbird operas. I picnicked with Dominican families. I took field trips to Woodbury Commons for massage chairs and grocery shopped in Hasidic villages. I joined the citizens of Chester for a blues concert overlooking an onion field. I shared a bucket of balls at a driving range in Goshen with a veteran just back from Kuwait. I slept atop a pile of crushed gravel the size of a bodega in the hamlet of Slate Hill. And I broke bread with as many friends along the way as I was able.
And so that's a big part of it, too, just the meeting people and immersing yourself in other cultures and environments.
Definitely, definitely. And trying to have those interactions that I wouldn't necessarily, you know, come upon in my daily life.
It's kind of cool to think about, especially kind of post-9/11, post-pandemic, that if you really had to, you could get back to your Catskills home if everything was closed down.
That is something I really wanted to try to help people understand. This resource is unparalleled. You know, you can go from the heart of the, arguably, the greatest metropolis on Earth to the forever wild forests and mountains of upstate New York, which are vast and incredible.
My very last day was actually my hardest. I climbed Mount Tremper. I climbed Edgewood Mountain, which is directly behind my house, and then bushwhacked from there to my property. So it was a few miles, and it was sort of like raining when I left, so it was really slippery. A few miles of, you know, with no trail and just using GPS and so forth. Just a really challenging section of bushwhacking through down a slippery mountainside to my creek and across it to my house. How about you? Are you convinced? Are you going to be hiking the Long Path anytime soon?
I'd like to do some sections of it.
Yeah, why not? It's a good place to start. In fact, I came to realize from this article how many people are doing segments of it, you know, as a group, and they're slowly completing it. There's a number of different groups that seem to be doing it piecemeal, which is also great. Any time spent walking in the woods is never wasted time, is never regrettable. You know, there's always something great that comes of it. And so I think, you know, I encourage those that are interested to take it in, you know, small bits and pieces or to tackle a longer section. And it need not be the long path either, just whatever path is around you.
For WJFF Radio Catskill, this is Brett Barry.
And you can hear the full episode of Cats Cast and all of the episodes of Cats Cast, the Catskills podcast, at catscast.com. We'll take a break, and when we come back, you'll have the time of your life at the Songs of Dirty Dancing tribute Saturday. We'll find out more after a break. This is Radio Catskill.
I'm Stephen Dubner on the next Freakonomics Radio.
Wherever there is history being made, the commodity traders are there.
Commodity traders often operate in the shadows, and their reach is enormous.
They are the bankers of last resort, and they're almost like diplomats for hire.
The most powerful people you've never heard of. That's next time on Freakonomics Radio. This afternoon at 1 o'clock on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Catskill. I'm Tim Bruno. It's been nearly 40 years since Dirty Dancing first hit the big screen, but the music, the moves, and the unforgettable Catskills setting still strike a chord. Now a group of local artists is bringing the soundtrack to life with a tribute concert happening Saturday at Pelkey's Tavern in Hankins, New York. The Songs of Dirty Dancing features a full live band performing 18 songs from this iconic film. And it features comedic hosts Bob Powers and Amanda Melson. I sat down with co-host Bob Powers and co-creator and guitarist Dave Keener to talk about how the show came together. Here's Dave.
I wanted to do a show that people would, this is going to sound weird, but actually be interested in coming to, like, say, versus my own original music, where you walk into the place and it's like, who is this guy? And every song is brand new. But, you know, Dirty Dancing, which is really my wife's idea, was like, well, this way you get to play all these, you know, 50s and 60s songs you love, and everyone loves this movie and will come out for it, you know. And on top of that, we have this Catskills connection, and we have Bob and Amanda, who are funny comedians who can host it for us. So it just seemed like a great idea.
People come in knowing kind of what they're getting into here. So how does it feel to be performing this movie, these songs from this film, in the region where it's set?
It's pretty cool, I think. I mean, yeah. I'm not going to be doing the performing of the songs.
But you'll be like our Borscht Belty host.
That's right.
Something. Yeah, I have – no, to me, it's a magical thing. Anytime playing music outside, which we're hoping this will be, in the summer, you know, surrounded by the mountains and greenery and Catskill summer fun. I don't know. To me, it's a magical thing.
Well, Bob, do you have a personal connection to Dirty Dancing at all? Is it one of your favorite films or in the top 10?
I mean, I love the movie. My wife really loves the movie. but I, you know, I've always liked the movie. And my wife, actually, even Amanda Melson, who is co-hosting with me, she corresponded with the screenwriter of the movie when she had written something online about it. Eleanor Bergstein, I think her name is. She found this essay that Amanda had written, this humor piece, and reached out to Amanda, and they you know, started chatting online. So that's a direct connection. It was very cool.
She said that Amanda, like, got the movie, like, more than other people or something.
Right,
like,
yeah,
that.
Yeah.
It's funny.
So you nailed it.
Can you tease out a little bit of the comedy in between songs that you might be featuring here?
Well, like, as Dave said, we're going to be trying to fill the role of the Borscht Belt host and also try to fill the role that, what's his name? The guy who ran the resort.
Yeah.
I can't remember
Mr.
that
Kellerman?
Actor's name.
Oh, like
Mr. Kellerman? I don't know. Anyway.
It's called Kellerman's Resort.
He was very charming and old school on stage, and then very mean to Patrick Swayze off stage. And
hey, wait a minute.
But we'll be, you know, just playing with various things throughout the movie. We're going to be honoring, we're going to be doing, you know, brief memorials for things like Jennifer Grey's old nose. We're going to be honoring Jerry Orbach's donated eyes after his death. I don't know if you know about that. But
can you tell me more about that?
In the New York City subway, after Jerry Orbach died, there were posters up for organ donation, and it was revealed that Jerry Orbach was an organ donor, and after his death, his eyes went to a recipient on the list, so then we all get to spend the rest of our lives wondering who has Jerry Orbach's eyes. And
talk to me about a little bit more about the process of translating the soundtrack for a live performance. The film only uses snippets. You guys are performing the full versions. What's that process been like?
Yeah, well, you have to come up with a band that you can actually, you know, attain on your budget. And they have to cover, 18 songs that really – we're done with 18 different bands of all sorts of different things. And the way we mostly do it is we have a keyboard player who is also a great synthesizer player, Charlie Roth, and he's going to bring in the piano playing, but also those violins that you hear in Will You Love Me Tomorrow or Be My Baby by the Ronettes. So he'll bring in all those violin sounds. And then I also have, we have three singers, four if you count one of our friends, Dave Milner, who's singing a song. And with that combo, we can kind of approximate the backup vocals that all these old songs have.
Was there a song that turned out to be especially challenging or maybe fun to bring to the stage?
Well, honestly, I'm into the older ones, but it has, like, you know, it's a commercial movie. It has a couple of 80s songs in it. I was never really in love with the song We've Had the Time of Our Life. Mm-hmm. It was not cool when I was 21 years old at that time. And that one is hard. It's got a lot of twists and turns. If they can, whoever wrote that, if they could make something different the second time you do it rather than the first time, so you have more to remember, they did it. It's got a big horn thing that happens 4/5 of the way through that I had to approximate on the guitar. So that one's nasty, and I've been practicing it for about a month.
Bob, any particular moment or line from the movie that you have especially been proud of working into your show?
Well, there is the famous line, Jennifer Grey's first line with Patrick Swayze, where I carried a watermelon. And then that's her very first line to him after she carried a watermelon into the party. And then immediately he leaves and she cringes and repeats to herself, "I carried a watermelon." So we are going to be having an "I carried a watermelon" pageant for anyone in the audience who wants to. Well, we'll probably get three participants to come up, hold a watermelon, deliver those two line readings, And then we'll have the audience vote on who is Miss I Carried a Watermelon, and the winner gets to walk away with a watermelon.
I mean, that is enticing right there. Mm-hmm. I mean, the film seems like it is ripe for a little parody.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I wonder if it's ever been parodied. Maybe not. They weren't doing a lot of those scary movie type things way back then.
I don't know. I do not know.
There should be a coming of age.
You know what? It's in a perfect Hollywood-y spot where it's like just a teens over the top in spots, and that's what makes it memorable. Like really, that line, no one puts baby in the corner, that seems like maybe the worst moment of the entire movie. If you sit down and watch it, you're like, actually everything else is really good in this movie. But
you're on your own there. I'm crying.
I'm crying, and so is the rest of the audience.
Okay. But it's a great
crying
story.
And cheering.
Are there plans after the July 5th Pelkey's Tavern performance to take it on the road or worldwide?
Yeah, we're going to take it on the road back to Pelkey's Tavern in the end of August. But
Watermelons in August.
I want to do this fresh show. I don't know about you, Bob, but I'd like to do this show, you know, every year. And, make it a tradition here in the Catskills and move it around. I don't want to take it particularly out of the Catskills, but, I would like to really connect it to the movie maybe by doing it in one of the hotels at some point.
Oh, wow.
I think that would be fun.
Site specific. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And, but I like doing it outdoors, doing the show outdoors too. So, but yes, I do plan to keep going with the show. We do plan to keep going with the show and try some new venues.
Don't want to put it in a corner. How many times have each of you watched Dirty Dancing in the past year? But let's be honest.
I think I only rewatched it once recently in the lead up to this.
I'm sorry to say the same. I've only watched it once. But whenever someone comes over our house or stays with us, my wife makes everybody watch either Moonstruck or Dirty Dancing. So I've now seen it like 3 or 4 times.
Mm-hmm. Maybe Moonstruck? Will there be a Moonstruck performance later maybe?
You know, there's really no music in it, Tim.
I would be so in. I'm not sure. Yeah. I'm not sure about that. Yeah, the only music is opera, though. I'm not sure.
That's a stretch for me.
Could you give us a little preview of one of the songs?
Sure.
Dave Keener with Songs of Dirty Dancing.
This is by the Drifters, and it's some kind of wonderful. All you have to do is touch my hand to tell me you understand. And something happens to me that's some kind of wonderful. Every time my little world seems blue, I just have to look at you. And everything seems to be some kind of wonderful. I know I can't express this feeling of tenderness. There's so much I want to say, but the right words don't come my way. I just know when I'm in your embrace. Wonderful, this world is a happy place. Wonderful, and everything seems to be wonderful, some kind of wonderful.
The Songs of Dirty Dancing, a tribute concert, is Saturday, July 5th at 7 at Pelkey's Tavern in Hankins. Bob Powers, Dave Keener, and Amanda Melson will be your hosts and performers. Thank you guys so much.
Thanks, Tim. Thank you. Thanks, listeners. And I hope
that's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. I had the time of my life. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from the Narrowsburg Union and Catskills Curated, presenting products of regional artists, artisans, makers, and craftsmen. Gift wrapping and shipping available on site. NarrowsburgUnion.com. The Cooperage Project in Honesdale, dedicated to building community through performance, learning, markets, and good times. thecooperageproject.org. And from listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
I'm Jason Tuga, host of The Mixtape. I play classics you love, deep cuts, and brand new music. Friday nights at 7, only on Radio Catskill.
WJFF Jeffersonville, streaming live at wjffradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR. High of 81 today. We might see some showers and thunderstorms, some heavy ones later. They could bring some flooding, downpours, and localized damaging winds. A thunderstorm around this evening as well. Cloudy, low 65, and humid,